And that one's to center field. Back goes Dubon. Gone! And Salvi hits it to left field. Hooking into the corner, and it's down. And now it bounces away. Here comes Junior around third. Salvi drives in another run, and it's 4-3 in the eighth.
And the Royals would, well, that was really the two highlights for the Royals yesterday as they end up losing to the Houston Astros 7-4 yesterday afternoon at the K. Wade, Jason, Dusty with you, Sports Ticket on this Monday, June the 6th. And the Royals did win 1 out of 3, so they avoided the sweep to the Astros as Colin Snyder gives up 3 in the ninth, and the Royals do lose. 17-35. That's right, 17-35. That means 17 wins and 35 losses for the Royals. Astros now 35-19. Royals continue a 10-game homestand, starting a 3-game series with the Blue Jays tonight. Daniel Lynch on the hill for the Royals in game one of the series. 2-4 ERA, just south of 5. Not good as last time out. First pitch 7-10 at Kauffman Stadium. Let's just jump into the Cubs update. I'm tired of talking Royals. Cubs update with Jason Broadfoot.
Brought to you by the movie High Fidelity, starring John Cusack.
Ah, big Cubs fan. Yes,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, he would not be happy as the Cubs lost 5-3 to the St. Louis Cardinals in 11 innings. Second straight game that the Cubs lost in extra innings to the Cardinals. Cubs won the first two of the series, had a chance to get a 4-game sweep, but lost the 2 in extra innings. So just when they start to think about them thinking about getting themselves somewhat into it, they lose 2 extra inning games and are 23-32.
23-32 sounds a lot better than 17-35.
Yeah.
But still not good. Not at all.
I'd just rather them lose just a normal 9-inning game, 5-3, than extra innings. But
I hear you. Yeah, why extend the suffering?
Yeah.
Yes, I totally understand that. Well, you could have been 27-17 feeling good about everything and then lose 11 in a row and now be under 500. You know what team's doing that right now?
I'm trying to think.
This shows how close you follow baseball. No, American League team.
Okay.
American League team that was off to a great start. 27-17 or right there pushing the Astros in their division.
Is it the A's?
No.
Angels?
There you go. Mike Trout and the Angels.
I thought it was Angels or A's probably.
The Angels have lost 11 in a row.
Man.
They were 27-17 and right there with the Astros, and now they are 8.5 games out of first. Because the Astros won 7 of the last 10, and the Angels lost 11 in a row. That's how quickly things can change. 2 bad weeks of baseball, or 2 really good weeks of baseball, can get right back in the thick of things. Especially in the division the Royals are in, and that's apparently what J.J. Piccolo and Dayton Moore and the Royals are hoping on. I had a good friend of mine, he texted me, he said, man, it's time for the Royals to blow this thing up, fire everybody in front office and trade the veterans. I said, what are you going to get for the veterans?
Yeah.
I said, I agree with you, really, honestly. It's time for a change. I agree. But I don't think you're going to get much for the veterans. Andrew Benintendi, we talked about it. Maybe get something for him. Well, you will get something for him. Scott Barlow would probably be the next big piece. Or if you went Salvador Perez's way, if somebody really needs a catcher, or they just make him a full-time DH, which Salvi probably wouldn't be happy with that. And I don't think Salvi's anywhere close to being traded. Although he's starting to heat up, as you heard in those highlights. A couple of things to baseball. I told you about 11-game losing streak by the Angels before we get to local sports. But also, and I was not aware of this, the Los Angeles Dodgers were prevented from pitching a position player during their half of the ninth inning Saturday night against the Mets after unwittingly violating a recent addition to the rule book. Yeah, did you guys know about this?
Once I read the article, I realized at one point I did know it, but
really,
I had forgotten it. Yeah,
I don't know anything about it.
I thought you could take a position player and put him in any time you wanted, and you in as a pitcher, and you can do that in any other level of baseball. Like for instance, we talked about it. You could have your right fielder come in, he could pitch, and then 2 innings later he leaves, and then 3 innings later he comes back to pitch as long as he still stays on the field and plays a position. That was the way baseball was too. But apparently, there was a rule that was agreed upon ahead of the 2020 season that would bar position players from pitching in games with a deficit of 5 runs or fewer unless they're designated two-way players, and the guy that the Dodgers were trying to use was not a two-way player. Now, the rule did not and was not enforced in 2020 due to COVID, shortened season, and in 2021 because of the pandemic and concern about player health and safety. But the rule is in place in 2022, even though it was officially in place 2021. And Dave Roberts, the manager of the Dodgers, said the goalposts have been moving a lot. It's an oversight on my part, but I do recall that we did it last year. They kind of had to confer to make sure that was the case. They got it right, the umpires. But last year was supposed to be a rule against it, and they allowed it. And it was a full season. This year, they did not. So I can understand the confusion a little bit. I did not know that rule existed, and I don't know why it does exist. I don't understand the point of why the rule exists. If you are a manager of your baseball team and you want to bring a position player in a tie game, who cares?
Right. Yeah, I don't
understand the problem with
not,
it.
Some people were...
It's not like anybody was abusing a guy. Like, oh, you know, I'm going to put Brett Phillips out there every 3 days to pitch.
Some people feel that some managers were abusing it. Like, just any time they were getting blown out or blowing somebody out, they would just use a guy in the ninth just to save their... Which
they still do. This rule doesn't stop that at all.
Right. But there were some that... They felt like maybe, you know, 6 or 7 runs. We've seen those comebacks before. And so, like, that team's just giving up. So they didn't care if they gave up another 3 or 4 if they were down 6 or 7. I
think it's stupid. I don't care. Because, you know, I think first of all, are you giving up when you are you giving up when you're up 9-4 and bring in a position player? If the Dodgers are up 5 runs, they're not giving up. They're ahead with 5. They were short on pitching you 6 pitchers. They want to use a guy's position player to pitch. They ain't giving up. They're up 5 runs.
No, I understand. I don't care. You should be able to use your team however you want
to use your team.
But I just know that this was the pushback was, you know, it might be 10-4 going into the ninth. And, you know, we saw it, you know, not necessarily one inning, but we saw a 6-run comeback, you know, and how, but we
that
said
was real pitchers the Royals used. Yeah. They would have been better off using Andrew Benintendi to come in.
But those, you know, the point is those things do happen every so often, and you're cheating. Apparently, you're cheating the fans of that 1 in 100 chance of it happening is what the pushback was. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's what the pushback was. So,
but here's the thing I don't understand.
That doesn't explain the five run part.
It doesn't explain the five.
Well, what they wanted to do.
You're down six. That's still legal.
If you're down 6, that explanation don't make any sense. I agree with you because if you're down 6, you can do it. So if you're saying, well, you bring a position player to pitch, you're waving a white flag, you're basically giving up. They're saying that it's okay to do that when you're down 6 or more, but if it's a 5-run deficit, you can't do it. But I would argue if you bring in a position player when you're up or down 5, that doesn't necessarily mean you're giving up because, one, you're just out of pitching, so you go with somebody to eat an inning. And honestly, it's good for baseball. People talk about Brett Phillips coming in, throwing a 52-mile-an-hour fastball, whatever it may be, and these other guys, Albert Pujols came in, pitched, and the Cardinals were up by, 10 runs or something, and it still happens anyway. Yeah. Like, if you want to, based on the explanation you gave, Jason, that would mean that they should just ban position players from pitching at all. If you want to get rid of that's not good for the game, and we're preventing people are giving up and they're quitting and so forth and so on, well, then why don't you just have a rule that says position players can't pitch at all? And I don't understand the 5-run thing. I'm with Dusty. I'm like, 6 runs or more, they allow it. I mean, it'd be one thing if they say 10 runs or more, but they're talking 6 runs or more. We just saw the Royals. Listen, if the Twins brought in a position player to pitch when they're down 6-0, all right, and then the Royals gave up 7 runs. I mean, it's not like the Twins gave up, although I thought they kind of were because they had 2 starters that weren't even in the lineup, their best players, and the Royals still lost. But if the Royals choose to bring in a position player pitching up 6-0, or if the Royals are down 6-0, why not? I don't see the problem here.
I'm not saying I like it. I'm just saying that they just wanted to put a line there that said this is acceptable and this is unacceptable. I'm not saying it's
right. Shouldn't it be the other way around, though? Shouldn't it be like if 10 or more runs, you can't allow a position player? Because that's the thing that's confusing to me. What? Who would wave the white flag down 5 runs?
Yeah, I can see your argument.
Who would, in this day of long ball baseball, where you're waiting for the three-run homer, and we've seen teams implode and give up leads. If you're, I guess the one thing I could come up with is you're down 12-0 in inning number four, and you bring in a position player. Well, everybody knows the game's over anyway. I mean, fans are leaving anyway. Everybody knows, and that's one thing I hate about baseball is that, well, okay, we got this rule, but then you're not supposed to swing on a 3-0 pitch. You're not supposed to bunt with a no-hitter. It's like, I thought you were supposed to try to win the game. So let's not, how about you ban these unwritten rules, which I don't know how you ban something that's unwritten, but then you have a rule like, well, okay, now 6 runs, you can bring in this guy. Like, if the Dodgers scored one more run, if they'd really worked hard to move the runners around and manufacture a run, they could have had the position player to pitch. They didn't, so now he can't come in to pitch when they're up 5. The other thing is, why doesn't, if you're up 5, why can't you use anybody you want? I would even argue you'd have a sub-counter rule that, okay, if you're down 6 or more, you can't do it. But if you're up 6 or more, why can't you? Because you're the one that did it. The Cardinals did it with Albert Pujols when they're up 10 runs. That ain't the Cardinals giving up. They're winning. They're, like, saving their pitching. It's smart baseball, actually.
My argument would be, what happens, like, in a 17-18-inning game that's tied? I know they're trying to put rules in to try to avoid that, but what happens if it happens?
Yeah, you run out of pitchers.
Yeah, you just use guys.
I would think at that point you're
done.
You have to go with position players at that point. I think maybe their point would be if their pitcher's available. Is that in the rule?
No,
or is it just straight
all.
You can't?
No.
And I think they were trying to avoid the unwritten rule thing where one person gets
unless
mad
you're
about
a designated
something.
Two-way player. Like Ohtani is a designated two-way player. That would be the exception to the rule. Based on the rule, there's nothing that says if you get to the 18th inning and you both run out of pitchers, listen, they ain't going to allow that. They're not going to have position players come in and pitch in a tie game. I mean, obviously, if it's 5 runs or less, they're not going to allow it either. So guess what? That puts the onus on the manager to go, listen, once I get to inning 16, if I go to my last pitcher, he's going to have to pitch the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what happens if there's an injury, if there's some kind of exception. Can you bring back a pitcher that – can you play a position player as a pitcher even though it's a tie game? Can you bring back a pitcher already pitched? I highly doubt that. I don't know. That's a good question.
Because there's been multiple times where there's been position players pitching in tight games when it gets to like a 14, 15, 16, whatever inning game.
Based on this rule,
the way the rules are set
it.
Up now, there shouldn't be 17 and 18 inning games
now
because you get the ghost runner at second. Yeah. So you're not going to see many of those, if any, but there's still always that possibility. I mean, it's always there. Even though you have all the ghost runners, maybe you'll tie at the end. Each team will get a run, you know, and you keep going. And so, I don't know. That just seems like if you get to a certain point where there's nobody else available, do you just forfeit if you can't pitch a position player? See, or you just, let a guy burn out his arm and not have a chance, but...
See, this is an extra rule they just didn't need. I was just trying to explain why they put it in, but I don't agree with it. I think you should be able to use your team however you want, and and most managers.
Okay, so there is a deal. I found a little bit more information about it because the story, of course, didn't have the full. It's CBS Sports, so the writers don't have the full stories ever. So. I did a quick Google and found it in 10 seconds, but writers can't do that. The only other times that position players would be allowed to pitch was going to be in extra innings or games their team was losing or winning by more than 6 runs. And then they reversed the rule for 2020 after they agreed to it. That would allow the position players to pitch at any point of any game in 2020 because of the shortened COVID season. Didn't have a lot of time to get, training camp and all that other spring training. So it does appear that you can use them in extra innings. So then, obviously, the 5-run thing doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah.
So that would make some sense there, but I just don't think it's necessary at all.
No.
I mean, you have 25 men on your roster. You should be able to utilize those guys any which way you want to use them. If you want to use a position player to start the second game of doubleheader as an opener, you should be able to do that.
Yeah. And we're not seeing the part that bothers me is we're not seeing guys
like
in the seventh
about
inning.
It anyway.
We're not seeing Brett Phillips pitch the seventh inning of a 3-2 game anyway.
Right.
We're only seeing him do this if it's 9-1 or if it's 10-4, we're not seeing that. We're not seeing it happen in key parts of close ball games unless it's extra innings, and then that just adds to the weirdness and kind of, I think, would be a nice, fun story, like you said, kind of a fun story that would get your baseball game on some more national level than, say, just winning 6-5 in a normal game. But, yeah, you're right. It's just a rule that doesn't need to be
there. I don't think there was anybody going, wow, we really need to change that. We couldn't change the universal DH until just this season. We tried that for 25 years. I mean, but we somehow can just make that quick change, and some people didn't know about it, including the manager of the Dodgers. After position players made 90 pitching appearances in 2019 and 75 in 18, Major League Baseball and its Players Association agreed prior to the 2020 season to outlaw using position players as pitchers in games with a deficit of 5 runs or fewer. It was not enforced in 2020, not enforced in a full season in 2021, but Saturday night it was enforced. Which the rule, you know, once again, if you don't get mad at the umpire for enforcing it. If you're a Dodger fan, it's the rules, and they enforced it. The thing is, why wasn't it enforced last year would be my question. I know 2020, yes, I get it, but it should have been enforced last year.
Why not just put them in and your first full year after you've approved this?
It's Major League Baseball. What do you expect? Yeah. All right, local sports, Dusty.
Hey, quite a bit going on. Obviously, right now it's all-star time. Volleyball, basketball, football, all-star games are going on, and two of them happen this weekend, and eight-man football all-star games coming up this weekend. And Kansas Volleyball Association held their annual All-Star match at Washburn's Lee Arena in Topeka Saturday night. Smith Center's Ashlyn Long played on the blue team, the red squad. Talon Rensselaer played on the blue team for Smith Center, while their coach, Nick Lynn, was also an assistant and a coach as part of the blue team as well. Long and the red squad picked up the win in the match, and Smith Center also picked up their KVA awards. Lynn was named the 2A Coach of the Year and Rensselaer the 2A Player of the Year in the fall, and so they got their hardware there for that. And the Lady Red were also given the KVA Team Academic Award and named the 2A Program of the Year. So congratulations to Smith Center getting recognized as the state champions in Class 2A in 2021, and a lot of honors there for them this weekend at the KVA All-Star Match. Also at Red Cloud this weekend, the Twin Valley Conference and Northern Plains League had the state line all-star basketball games. On the girls' side, the Twin Valley Conference won 47-40, and the boys' game, Twin Valley Conference won 64-51. We'll have more info on that with kind of some box scores coming up later, either this morning or this afternoon at ncksports.com. So that's what happened over the weekend. And again, coming up this weekend is the 37th annual eight-man all-star games coming to Beloit. Again, 80 of the best players, top senior football players in the state, have been selected to play in this game. There is at least one injury already, so that number will be bound down to 79 coming into town tomorrow. The players will arrive, and we'll have features and things going throughout the week. For the latest in information for the 8-Man All-Star Games, visit 8manallstars.com. Games on Saturday, the Division I game will be the early game with pregame at 9:30 on Katy Country 94 and 8manallstars.com, and kickoff at 10 o'clock, and then the Division II game will follow at 1:30 coming up on Saturday afternoon. So we're looking forward to it. And again, we'll have coverage this week from 8-Man All-Stars in Beloit. We're happy to have it and ready to see some of the best football players strap them up again this week.
Weather's going to be pretty good right now. 81 for the high on Saturday, I saw the other day. Of course, that might change by
the time we get there. Let's keep it there.
That's right. And Jason, I told him on the sidelines he needs to wear sunscreen. Our intern, Joe Ortner, got fried to a crisp.
Yes.
He was fried more than chicken ever was. That's how bad he was fried. It was not good. He was blistering, and it was not good. No. I mean, it was not good. so we'll make sure to put the sunscreen on. Even 81, you can still fry and get burned. So we look forward to having 8-Man All-Star Games. 8-Man Pep Rally will be on Friday at 8 o'clock, or 4 o'clock, I should say. 4 o'clock. Friday Night Lights is later in the evening there at the NCK Technical College. But the Pep Rally, the 11th year, and that was an idea that we came up with, and then it kind of took off. This 11th year doing the Pep Rally, and it'll be at Chautauqua Park in the shade down there near the pool. And that'll go from 4 to 5, so it'll be a lot of fun. So come on out. We'll have the players do some fun things and competitions. That's the fun things planned. Maybe even some audience member participation we'll incorporate this year as well. So be down there. There'll be shaved ice down there as well. So we look forward to the Pep Rally, the 11th annual Pep Rally there at Chautauqua Park, starting at 4 o'clock on Friday. So if you are in town, or if you're from the area, you're listening right now, take the kiddos, the family, and have a good time. It doesn't cost anything to attend. All right, the NBA Finals. Game 2 was last night, and the Warriors, game 1, game 2, somewhat similar. Except the difference this time, the Celtics didn't have a big rally in them in the fourth quarter. The Warriors with another big third quarter.
Golden State has a lot of time. Poole with the ball. Launches. Oh! Money!
It was money. That one from nearly half court by Jordan Poole. And when the Warriors start making threes, it is contagious. I mean, when Curry makes a deep one, falling into the bench like he did last night, then Poole hits one from nearly half court. It just, and remember, the Warriors last night, Klay Thompson couldn't make anything, and they still won comfortably by 19, 107 to 88 last night. Here's Steve Kerr on the third quarter performance and what Steph Curry did to really will his team to a victory.
Steph was breathtaking in that quarter. Not just the shot making, but the defensive effort. He just doesn't get enough credit for his level of conditioning and physicality and defense. People go at him to try to wear him down because they know how important he is to us offensively. It's pretty dramatic, the difference in Steph's strength and physicality and his body now than from, you know, 8 years ago when I first got here. So the guy's amazing. He just keeps working on his game, his strength, his conditioning year after year, and it's a pleasure to watch him play every night.
Yeah, Steph Curry, one of the best in the business, one of the greatest of all time. Many believe he's the greatest shooter of all time as well. Warriors roll to the victory. You know, a couple of observations from last night. First of all, Warriors got hot in third quarter. That's been a theme throughout the playoffs. The Warriors have been really good in the third quarter. Last night, 35-14 in the third and blew it open after it was tight there at halftime, and the Celtics didn't have an answer. Curry with 29 last night. Poole with 17 off the bench. Gary Payton the second came back. I think he had an impact in the game. We talked about how he could be an X factor. We said Jason Tatum would bounce back and play better. He did last night with 28 points. Problem is he didn't have enough help last night in game two of the NBA Finals. And we talked about this as well, role players. This is pretty interesting stuff. So Al Horford at 28 points, or 26 points in game one. He was scoreless in the first half last night, didn't take a shot to the second half, finished with 2 points. Derek White had 21 points and 5 threes in game one. He had 12 points last night. Marcus Smart had 4 threes and 18 points in game one. He had 2 points last night. Grant Williams, Peyton Pritchard, nobody really did anything off the bench for the Celtics. So the role players didn't do anything, while Gary Payton II added more depth off the bench for the Warriors. Of course, Curry was fantastic last night. And then the Celtics, we talked about turnovers. Before the series began, we talked about how people are talking about how the Celtics can get sloppy with the basketball. So can the Warriors. I think the Celtics are sloppy and the Warriors are careless. And you may say, well, what's the difference? I think the Celtics, I don't know. To me, there is a difference. I think the Warriors just get a little bit bored every once in a while, whereas the Celtics are just, they're just sloppy. And they have these stretches where they turn the ball over, and some of these turnovers are just kind of like mystifying. You're like, what are you doing? What did you even see on that play? And last night they had 19 turnovers, and that turned into 33 points for the Warriors. And if the Celtics can cut down the turnovers, protect the basketball, and don't have these live ball turnovers, if dead ball turnover, you can deal with it, then the Warriors can't get out in transition as much, and that's when they really get themselves going. When they get in transition, you're trying to find Curry, you're trying to find Poole, and the best time to take a three, and the way the game is now, is in transition. You know, I saw a couple of kids on our basketball team when we had a tournament in Hayes this weekend that my son, one of his favorite shots is transition. You come down, you're already on your heels, you're going backwards as a defender, and that's the best time to stop, pull, and nail it. Now, back in the day, that used to be like, you got to have all five guys back, and we got to have four rebounders. It's like, no, that's the best time to take that shot because, one, you're going to get a clean look. And that's what Curry does all the time. That's what Poole does. You see all the three-point shooters in the NBA, they love that shot, that transition. Right? Three on two, two on two. It might be even one on two. It's like, dude, I know I'm going to make it. I know I can make it. And you're comfortable, and you don't have to think as much. You just dribble right into it. Your momentum is going straight towards the bucket, and you drain a three. And you see it from Klay Thompson. You see it from Poole. You see it from Steph Curry and some of the Ray Allen did that quite a bit in his career, no doubt, as well. One of the greatest three-point shooters in NBA history. So the game has changed from back in the 80s to where it is now in regards to the wide openness of, hey, you're open, take it. Oh, yeah, but I only got one guy underneath the rebound. Who cares? You're a really good shooter. Take it. That's a good shot. Instead of allowing the defense to get set. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be, well, we don't have enough rebounders. Well, you're assuming you're going to miss it. But if you make it, the defense never got set and couldn't defend it. And so it's a really good shot. So that's one thing that hurts the Celtics is when the Warriors can get a turnover, live ball, and then boom, transition. And then when Curry hits one or two, you know what happens. He gets excited, and especially at home, the crowd gets jacked. And Poole is kind of like a mini Steph Curry in regards to how hot he can get when he makes a couple and hit that half-court shot. But the Celtics got to do better with the turnovers. Klay Thompson last night was not good, and the Warriors won by 19. Klay Thompson was 4 of 19, 1 of 8 from 3. He finished with 11 points. He was left out there in the fourth quarter with subs to try to get himself going, which I thought was probably a good move by Steve Kerr. So once again, here we go. So after game one, it was, well, the Warriors are in trouble, right? And Celtics, man, that was impressive fourth quarter. And this Celtic team's so tough. And we talked about, after game one, how do you want to look at it? Do you want to look at it as, hey, Jason Tatum played horrible. He was 3 of 17, although he did have 13 assists. 3 of 17 from the floor. The Celtics won, and their best player didn't really do a lot offensively. That's the thinking, right? So imagine what the Celtics would do. You know Tatum's going to come out and play a lot better in game two. Whenever he's had a clunker in the playoffs, he comes back and he has a really good game. And guess what? He had 21 in the first half last night. So after game one, you're going, man, it's going to be tough for the Warriors. I mean, dude, the Warriors lost the game and Tatum didn't even play well. Yeah, but Al Horford had 26 points. Derrick White had 21 points. Marcus Smart had 18 points. You really think those guys are going to, you know, Tatum goes from, you know, whatever he had in game one. Let's say, I don't even remember what he had, how many points he had, but he goes from, you know, 12 to 28. Okay, that's 16. That's 16 more points. But Horford went from 26 to 2. Yeah. So now we're negative 6 just like that. So there was two ways of thinking after game one if you're a Celtics fan. Man, that was awesome. We won that game, and imagine we won it and Tatum didn't play very well. Can't imagine what we can do in game two if he plays better. The flip side of that argument for the Celtic fan was, I don't think those role players can do that again in game two. That was insane. We were 21 of 41 for three. We might not do that again in game two, let alone in the rest of the series. The Warriors' perspective was, man, we let that one get away. If we just played like we played the first three quarters, we would have won. And we just had a really tough shooting night in the fourth quarter, so forth and so on. The defense looked really bad because the Celtics are moving the ball and making everything. And you look really bad defensively when other teams make shots. You look great defensively when they clank those open shots. It's just the way it is. I don't know how many times I've seen Bill Self in Kansas after a game. Bill will say, they'll be like, well, how about your defense? You know, honestly, our defense wasn't as good as people think it was. They had several wide open looks. They just didn't make them. And then there's times where Self will go, man, our defense was pretty doggone good, but those guys just made shots. And it's a make-or-miss league. You've heard it 1,000 times over. It's a make-or-miss league. The Celtics made their shots in game one. The Warriors didn't in the fourth quarter. In game two, the Warriors got hot and made everything in the third quarter, and Celtics didn't have a response. And so the narrative goes from after game one, oh, the Warriors are in trouble. The Celtics stole game one, and their best player didn't play very well. And then after the Warriors win last night, you know what the narrative is? Man, you know, the Warriors should be up 2-0. The Celtics are lucky to be tied in the series. The Warriors have basically outplayed them for 7 of 8 quarters. Wait a minute. You just said the Warriors are in trouble after, what, one quarter? They have one bad quarter, and they're in deep trouble? And we talked about it. Don't overreact to each game, all right? Just like people shouldn't overreact that the Warriors ran away with it last night. This series, the narrative should be this. If you didn't have all these people sensationalizing everything on sports talk and on TV and everything else, the narrative should be this. The Warriors and Celtics are the two best teams in basketball right now. They were the two best teams the second half of the season. Well, the Warriors had injuries, so they really weren't. But the Warriors and the Celtics are the two best teams. They're playing the best of anybody in the playoffs. That's why they're in the NBA Finals. They're both outstanding defensively. The Warriors showed some of that last night. I still think the Celtics are better defensively. Offensively, there's no doubt the Warriors are more explosive than the Celtics, but they live by the three more so than the Celtics do. But the bottom line is they're two different type of teams, but they have similarities, and they're both outstanding basketball teams. They can win sometimes with their offense. Sometimes they can win with their defense or keep themselves in the game. But at the end of the day, this series is exactly where it should be. If you want a great NBA Finals series, this series is already better than last year. The Suns were up 2-0 and people were writing off the Bucks, which was a mistake. And the Bucks won four in a row. And the whole narrative was the Bucks can't defend the pick and roll. They can't defend Ayton and Paul and Booker. The Suns have too many weapons, so forth and so on. Giannis doesn't have enough help. I remember the narrative leaving Phoenix. And we talked about on the show, like, you know what? There's some things the Bucks did that you think they can build upon going to game three. And once you go home, you have the energy of the home crowd. And the team up 2-0 has what? A little bit of a letdown, which I think we saw. Next thing you know, you lose game three. Now it's 2-1. You lose game four. Now we're back to even Steven. Everything I gained, I just lost. So now I'm back to square one. Okay, the Warriors, all they did last night, because this is people that are going to overreact the other way. Well, okay, the Celtics just got the Warriors' number. Celtics are the better team. I was wrong in my pick of the Warriors. And I tried to tell a couple of people that told me, I was wrong in my pick. I'm like, no, you're not. That was one game. If you picked the Warriors to win game one, you were wrong on that. But you're not wrong. If you picked the Warriors to win in five, you're technically not wrong yet. If the Warriors won in six or seven, if you had Boston in five, six, or seven, nobody's wrong. The only people that are wrong is if they had a sweep. If somebody picked a sweep, that's it. That's the only people that are wrong right now. So you have game one, the Celtics pulled one out, played great fourth quarter. Game two, the Warriors bounced back. That's what they're supposed to do. The Warriors, honestly, haven't accomplished anything other than... No. They avoided going down 0-2 because the Celtics accomplished everything they wanted to accomplish. When you are the team that does not have home court advantage in any series, a best of five, a best of seven, the first two games are always on the road because you're the underdog, right? So you have to go on the road. Your job is to not win two. Your job is to steal one, to get one. And if you get one, now, if you hold serve on your home court the rest of the series, you win the series. It's as simple as that. I know it's not that simple, but it is simple as that to explain it. The Celtics don't have to win another game in San Francisco the rest of the series. That's what they've accomplished. The Celtics have accomplished way more than the Warriors have through the first two games, and yet people are going to focus on the last game last night and go, oh, man, the Warriors figured out the Celtics. Well, what happens if Al Horford and Derek White start making those shots again? And then you go home, and your role players typically play better on your home floor. The Celtics accomplished more than the Warriors because they had more to gain. The Warriors simply needed to hold serve like the Suns did last year. And we saw what happened. Holding serve didn't do the Suns any good. Other than they were up 2-0, people got excited, Bucks held serve, we were back on serve for game five. And then the Suns lost. And then it was like, this series might be over. This series is just getting started, and I think it's fantastic that the first two games, it was a split. I'm glad the Warriors won last night, because if they lost last night, it would have been, oh my gosh, the Warriors are toast. They're dead, which they technically were not, but the Warriors won. Let's not freak out and say the Celtics are way better because they had a great fourth quarter. Let's not freak out, well, the Warriors are way better because they got hot in the third quarter. These teams are good enough to get hot at times, or their defense is good enough to put the others into a long funk and make a run. And no lead really is safe in this series, I don't think, for either team. I could see Boston going back Wednesday night. And I could see the Celtics getting up by 15 and blowing that lead. I could see the Warriors paying them back in almost the same way. The Warriors down 15-20 and have a big third or fourth quarter and get right back in it, and they might steal one. But the Celtics right now, they don't have to win a road game. The Warriors do. The Warriors have to win a game in Boston. The Boston Celtics don't have to win another road game in the series, and that's why the advantage is Celtics. And people will say, Warriors, they played great last night. They won by 19. How can you say the Celtics are in charge? They're in charge because they don't have to win a road game. The Warriors do.
That's how home court advantage works.
That's
right?
How it works.
When you lose it, you lose it, but you can gain it right back, right? Yeah. And so, but if Golden State wins, then Boston probably will have to win another road game to win the series, right? If
they will have to.
Right now, they don't have to win another road game, but Golden State can change that right away in game three if they go and steal home court back. And we've seen it in the playoffs this year. And so, so that's what home court is, and that's why you want to have home court advantage, because you have that luxury of the fact that, you know, if you just go out and win the rest of your home games, you get the series. And that's where Boston sits right now. And, you know, I'm not surprised at what happened last night. You know, Boston got their game, and you don't expect Derek White and Al Horford to play like that two games in a row on the road. You just don't you don't expect it to happen in any series.
That's why it was ridiculous to say the Warriors were in big trouble.
And I was never going to say they're in trouble. It's
concerning.
It's concerning because you lost the first game at home. That's where any kind of trouble or concern comes, is exactly is you're up by 14 late in the third quarter and didn't hold on to it, and Boston just obliterated you in the fourth. And so, yeah, you're just not going to get those kind of things from your role players all the time on the road. So that's why it's important for Boston that they did make the comeback and were able to pick up the win there. So, yeah, I mean, Boston absolutely gained more over the first two games of this series than Golden State did, because Golden State still needs to go on the road and win one of these games. And so, I expect, you know, Derek White to play better in Boston.
I expect Jalen Brown to do better in 5 of 17.
Absolutely, yeah. And even the non-role players that maybe didn't have a good game one or two are going to be better on their home floor. That's just all over the place. It's the course. That's how things work, right? And you have people backing you. You have a crowd that backs you, too, and it kind of gives you more juice as well. So there's all kinds of things that are right now in favor of Boston, only because of the fact that they stole the first game. And so that's where you go. Now you go home and you try to build off of that if you're the Celtics and make sure that Golden State doesn't steal it back. And you're sitting in really, really good position. And my prediction is sitting in really, really good position right now, right?
After game two, or after game one, the talk was Tatum. You know, the Celtics won. Tatum didn't play very well. After game two, the Warrior fans can say, we won by 19 and Klay Thompson went 4 for 19. Yeah. Celtics can counter and say, yeah, we lost, and Jaylen Brown went 5 of 17. Tatum went 8 of 19. Derek White went 4 of 13. Marcus Smart was 1 of 6. We shot 38%. We aren't that bad of shooters.
Yeah.
And we're going to be in the friendly confines of our home gym. We're going to have 2 days off to regroup and make counter adjustments. So game three is going to be very interesting. Now, having said that the Celtics don't have to win another road game in the series to win the championship, that is an absolute fact. Odds are they're going to have to win another road game at Golden State. You know what the Celtics' home record is in the playoffs so far? They played 9 games. What do you think their home record?
I was going to say it's probably like 6-3 or 5-4.
5-4.
Yeah, because they've lost some home games they shouldn't have lost.
They lost a game in Miami. Well, the Miami-Boston series, the road team won a lot.
Yeah.
The Milwaukee series, the Celtics lost game 5, and you're like, uh-oh, they're going to lose game 6 in Milwaukee. They came back 1 game 6 and 1 game 7. But the Celtics are better on the road. They're 8-3. So then, let's say the Celtics lose game 3 Wednesday night. The narrative, oh, Celtics had their chances. The Warriors got home court. This series is over. No, it's not. The Celtics can easily go to Golden State and win another road game, because the Celtics are actually better on the road than they are at home in the playoffs. And granted, you're playing the best teams in the league, but the Celtics are 8-3 on the road. They're 5-4 at home. So Celtic fans, you know what? We're going 3-1. We got one. We're going to get to 2 at home. We're up 3-1 going back to Golden State for game 5. Odds are it's going to be 2-2. Going back to San Francisco, and odds are Golden State's going to get home court back. That would be my prediction. They're going to split the next two.
Most people would probably agree with that now. Yeah,
I think actually that how I would think, I would pick that Golden State wins game 3, and then Boston wins game 4. But either way, it don't matter.
Yeah.
I think 2-2. Do anybody think that the Warriors are going to win both in Boston? Do anybody think Boston?
No, I don't think they'll win both.
Do you think Boston's going to win both in Boston?
No.
If I was going to predict, I would lean more toward Boston winning both in Boston than Golden State.
Yeah.
But right now I think they're both probably going to take one.
Gonna be fun. It's been fun so far. Speaking of fun, I saw Top Gun a second time. Now, here's why I did. I have never watched a movie in my life twice at the movie theater, except with the movie Inception. And I've explained this before, but if you're tuning in a little bit late, my wife and I went into the wrong theater. There was two different theaters in this huge theater complex, I think, at Oklahoma City at the time. And Inception was showing in two theaters. And I don't know if we misheard the theater number we're supposed to go to or what. We went in, and we thought we just missed a minute or two of the movie, because it was kind of a weird start anyway.
Sure.
And we were 30 minutes into it. Later, we found out later that we're like, wasn't that movie supposed to be longer? And it got done earlier. Like, I thought that was supposed to be 2 hours or something. It's like, I was hour 35. Oh, yeah, that's weird. And then we found out later, oh, yeah, we missed the first half hour. So then a week later, when Beloit Inception came to Sun Valley Cinema, my wife and I went and watched it, because, like, we kind of need to know the first part would help on this movie. And I still was confused and everything, no matter after. I could watch it 18 times, and I still wouldn't figure it completely out. But Top Gun Maverick, the sequel to Top Gun, which is an outstanding movie, everybody in my family had seen the movie, but my oldest son had to work when we all saw the movie on an afternoon. And so we were looking at the schedule, because we don't know for sure if the Sun Valley Cinema will have Top Gun a third week. It's good through Thursday. And he's got basketball stuff going on a couple nights. He's got to work at his job until 7 o'clock, and there is no 9:30 show at the Sun Valley Cinema, at least not at this point in time. So it's like, he really wanted to see it. So we get done with our last game of the day at the Hayes basketball tournament, and I said, you know what, son? I said, to make sure that you can see it, they have all kinds of different times here at Hayes, and there was an 8:30 showing in the evening for Top Gun Maverick. And I said, as long as we get done in time, we can get there, and we can, you know, just you and me can go straight there. I said, I have no problem watching a second time. I've never actually watched a full movie twice in the theaters. Never. Inception would be the closest. And he said, well, that would be great. So our game got over in plenty of time. Him and I went to the theater in Hayes. We went to see Top Gun Maverick. We got there a half hour early, in essence, which is fine. We sat down, got a pick of our seats, and we thought, you know, it might not be second week. It might not be that full. And there's a lot. There was a showing at 9:30, 10:30. There were showings before it. And by the time the movie started, there were not a lot of empty seats, hardly any empty seats in that theater. So Top Gun, my dad is rolling in it when it comes to the box office revenue. Okay, it is kicking butt. Number one movie in America. It's not even that close. And will be for a while, apparently.
Just
and
makes the inheritance that much
That's
better.
Right. I can't wait till that happens. I'm not holding my breath, because if I did, I'd be dead. I was like, okay, how do I want to approach this? I've seen it once, and I also wondered how many people in that theater had already seen it, like me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's part of what keeps this thing going, is I think people do want to go see it multiple times. I have always thought it's silly. You've seen a movie once, unless you didn't understand it. If it was very confusing, you know, like Inception, then you might want to go back and watch it. Or you want to go, oh, I didn't see that curveball. Let me watch it again, because I want to see what I missed. There were clues and I missed it. I understand that. But if it's just kind of a comedy or it's an action movie and there's not really any big curveballs, which there really aren't in this one, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, then really what's the point of watching a second time? Well, I really enjoyed it the first time, and I thought, how do I want to go into this? I'm not going to say much to my son. I don't want to ruin it. I want him to enjoy it for the first time. He'd seen the original. I saw the original after I saw the sequel, because Jason told me there was a one last day of Netflix had it, so I took advantage of that, and I watched it, which was really good that I did that. So I watched the new one, the old one, and now the new one a second time. And I'm really glad I did, because then I got to see even more similarities that I knew there were similarities between the two, but then I saw even more when I watched the second time after seeing the original, after I hadn't seen the original in years. And everybody, and I also listened to whenever there was a little bit of a funny part or some kind of something, to the crowd's reaction, because each theater you go to, I went to the one in Beloit the first time, this one in Hayes, is the reaction a little bit different to certain moments of the movie. But I was sitting there thinking when I started to watch it, I'm like, dude, I'm going to zero in. I'm going to zone in on, is there a mistake in the movie that I didn't notice? You know, is a plane's decal the wrong way? I'm going to look at more of the background, like try to zoom out to get the bigger picture, you know, to see the background, see what this is going on, blah, blah, blah. And I did that for a few minutes, and then I just got sucked into watching exactly the way I watched it before. And I knew what was coming, and I still enjoyed it. And that means it's a great movie. If you can watch a movie multiple times, that means you really enjoy the movie. You really like it. And it is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I still refuse to say it's better than the original, because I think it is as good. But I have a hard time. I always have a soft spot in my heart for the original, no matter what it is. I know Dusty does, too. But it was interesting. That's the first time I've ever seen a movie from start to finish twice in the theaters.
Did you catch anything that you missed the first? Just, it doesn't even have to be that big. I know, like you said, that it's not a plot movie necessarily. But
I think the one thing, it's funny you ask that question, because I really, after I left, I didn't think I did. But now that you say that, I start thinking about looking at the terrain of where they fly, the terrain when they were training, and the terrain when they're actually doing the big mission or whatever. And there was a couple things like, there might have been a flaw there. But I don't want to. It's no big deal. But yeah, that would be the thing I noticed. Is like the fighting scenes, I noticed the background more as to where they were fighting. Right. Otherwise, I think I pretty much was like, hey, yep. Saw that. I tried to pay attention to the intricacies of the planes a little bit more, and how they flew and where they took off and so forth and so on. But now I'm guilty, and I'm now part of that group that's seen a movie more than once in the theater, in the first showing at the theater. I'm guilty. And would I watch it a third time? Yeah. Not in the theater. I'm done with that. But come out and be on regular TV, yeah, I would watch it. Just like I watched original Top Gun many times. Like I've watched Major League many times. Dumb and Dumber many times. Dusty's watched Scream and other movies we've all watched that we like. That's what a lot of people do. This, it comes out in syndication on TBS, TNT. You're like, I know how this ends. I like Days of Thunder for some reason. That's not even a good movie. But for me, I liked it. And every time I see Days of Thunder, I somehow stop, quit what I'm doing, and I watch, even though I've seen it 10, 15, 100 times, and I watch it. I just watch it. I get sucked in like a vacuum cleaner.
I will go to a movie a second time in the theater, but I kind of have some rules with it. If I do the popcorn and pop and full price movie the first time, I won't, because that's...
Oh, so you're cutting off the concessions the second time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The budget only so much for one movie.
You expanded the budget to buy the ticket to go a second time, but you cut it off at the concession.
Yeah. But if I like say I go the first time and don't get the concessions, then liked it, I might go the second time. And, of course, that's... You know, back when I had the big multiplexes, Carney had multiple showings. They had a difference between daytime and nighttime tickets. So if I could go in the daytime and get the cheaper ticket the second time,
then you could afford some popcorn.
Right. Yeah. So I have a little budget on each movie. But if I blow it out the first time, I don't go a second.
I was surprised. Like, we went to the movies in Wichita. We had a basketball tournament, and we watched Bad Guys, the animated movie. That's actually pretty good. The whole family enjoyed that one, and we wanted to kill some time in the evening, went and watched that. And down there at Wichita, the tickets were like, it was... on average, $10 to $11 a ticket for my whole family, on average, about 10 or so. It's Sun Valley Cinema Beloit, you know, I think it's $5. Of course, we get tickets and stuff and give away, and that's very cheap to watch a movie. At Hayes, I was surprised. It was $6.09 to watch it for adult.
Even for a night show, huh?
Yeah, I was surprised. I thought it would be higher than that.
For Saturday night, I figured it would be way higher than
that. Yeah, I mean, the concessions are still higher than, obviously, Beloit, but not as high as Wichita. But the ticket price surprised me. And then my parents, they said they saw it. And my mom's like, "Oh, we got in for like $4. I'm like, "Yeah, I think they applied a discount for you." And she's like, "Oh, they didn't say anything." I'm like, "Let me look it up." I looked it up. She goes, "They didn't even ask." I'm like, "Apparently you're old enough, they don't have to ask." So they got for like $4.19 the senior discount. So that's something to look forward to and get old. You get the senior discount.
Yeah, for sure.
I can't wait for those breakfasts.
I've got movies four times then.
Yeah.
When I'm old.
And you're retired. You could watch a movie four times instead of two. Great idea. And you can splurge with popcorn all the way through. Yeah. You can get the same thing, exactly the same thing, to watch the exact same movie, just a different time of day. Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, the NHL playoffs, the Lightning get the win to keep their chances alive.
Saved by Shesterkin, a beauty. Hedman, slot, shot, score! Andre Palat makes it 3-2, Tampa Bay, with 41.6 to go.
Big goal for Tampa Bay, the two-time defending Stanley Cup champions. They cut the series lead to 2-1. Rangers still up 2-1, Eastern Conference Finals. Game 4 is tomorrow night in Tampa. Colorado Avalanche have a 3-0 series lead over the Oilers. They won 4-2 over Edmonton in Edmonton on Saturday night. They can advance to the Stanley Cup Finals with a win tonight and get the sweep. That's at 7 o'clock tonight on TNT from Edmonton. And Rafael Nadal does it again at the French Open.
It's another outrageous run for Rafa at Roland Garros. Number 14 in the books.
Rafael Nadal, 14th French Open title, by far the most in history, as nobody else in the Open era has won more than six in their career on the men's side. In the process, he won his 22nd overall Grand Slam title. Yesterday morning at Roland Garros, he rolled to a three-set, straight-set victory, 6-0 in the final set, over a guy 13 years younger than him, Ruud. And so Nadal, the five seed, rolls to the straight set win over Casper Ruud to claim the championship. And what's interesting, he said afterwards, and Jason and I were talking about this day, a waterside wake-up, Nadal came out afterwards and he said that he was playing with basically his foot. One of his feet were asleep. Mm-hmm. He had injection for issue he has with a foot, and his foot was numb. And as Jason accurately pointed out, isn't it bad enough that a guy that's 13 years older than you beats you in a major championship, and not only beats you, but kicks your butt, 6-3, 6-3, 6-love. So he only got six games off the guy. He's 13 years older than you, but yet he's somehow faster than you, apparently. He's smarter than you. He's a better player than you. And he beat you with one foot! He ran around the tennis court on clay sliding, and he was really using... Yes, he had 2 feet, but he couldn't feel one of them. Imagine how bad that match would have been had he been able to feel both feet. So Nadal says he may need major surgery, doesn't know yet, doesn't want to go the same route for Wimbledon. He wants to play Wimbledon, but not sure. So if he doesn't get, you know, if he has surgery, he probably miss Wimbledon, maybe some other majors. So, you know, father time catches up to you, but the 36-year-old takes out the 23-year-old yesterday at Roland Garros, Rafael Nadal. He's 35 or 36. Anyway, he's way older, but somehow he makes it look easy. And on the women's side?
Yeah, Iga Swiatek.
Iga!
Straight sets over Coco Gauff on Saturday morning. Iga's won 35 matches in a row, which is the most in women's tennis, the longest winning streak since 2000 when Venus Williams did it. Or I believe it was Venus that did it in 2000. And Iga's playing unreal tennis right now. She was just as dominant as Nadal was in his win, for sure.
Iga over Coco. That sounds interesting. Yeah. Names. I like that. By the way, Rafael Nadal is 36 now. He just turned 36 3 days ago.
Okay, I thought it was during this tournament.
13 years older than the 23-year counterpart, and he whips him 6-3, 6-3, 6-love, and one of his feet was asleep. That, my friends, is an all-time great right there. Rafael Nadal with 22 major titles. Jokic and Federer behind him with 20.